ever stand up, they will change America and change the world for their children and their children's children.
Former Oakland Congress member and chair of the Armed Services Committee, Ron Dellum, speaking at a conference recently in Washington, D.C. It was called Vietnam, The Power of Protest. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like to get a DVD copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Also, to watch or listen to or read the transcript of today's or any day's show, go to democracynow.org as well. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Aaron Mate, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkoff, Hani Massoud, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Anna Osbeck, Mike DeFilippo, and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Student Debtors Assembly, Thursday, May 28th, 2 p.m. in the Park Block at Southwest Harrison in Portland. A Debtors Assembly is a public forum to talk about debt, to dispel stigmas, myths, and taboos about debt, to learn about debt, and to organize to change the state of debt in our lives. There will be presentations from organizers, academics, debtors, artists, and musicians, and there will be opportunities for everyone to share openly about their debt and how it affects their lives. Again, that's the Student Debtors Assembly, Thursday, May 28th at 2 p.m. on the PSU Park Block near Southwest Harrison. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage on the community events.
KBOO is proud to partner with Hopworks Urban Brewery for their Community Tap program. Every month, Hopworks features a local nonprofit organization, and May's Community Tap is your community radio, KBOO. Hopworks is located at 2944 Southeast Powell Boulevard in Portland. For more information on Hopworks and their Community Tap program, you can go to kboo.fm/hub.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News... A white officer in Cleveland is acquitted after shooting an unarmed black couple.
Ireland makes history by becoming the first country to vote to legalize gay marriage.
And a Washington state activist stages a protest on the Arctic Challenger.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, May 25th, 2015. I'm Eric.
And I'm Liam. Ecoforest Management has sold 3,200 acres of land back to the Coquille tribe. The Coquille tribe is the ancestral owner of the land. Members of the tribe used tax credit financing and other support to close the deal. The Coquille tribe has been recognized by Congress since 1989, but that recognition did not come with a reservation. The tribe has renamed the land Sequetse. It's located just south of Bandon on the Oregon coast.
Activist Chiara D'Angelo spent 3 days this weekend on the anchor chain of the Arctic Challenger, protesting Shell's plans to drill in the Arctic. On Friday, during ongoing protests against Arctic drilling in Bellingham, D'Angelo separated from protesters and climbed the anchor chain. She strapped herself with a harness and stayed there even when the Challenger threatened to leave the dock. Other protesters climbed the chain as well to give D'Angelo supplies. The U.S. Coast Guard spent the weekend trying to figure out how to get D'Angelo down. There have been widespread protests in the Northwest and Seattle since Shell announced its Arctic drilling plans. Last week, so-called Kai activists met a floating drill rig that is preparing to head to Arctic regions of Alaska in order to start drilling. D'Angelo, a 20-year-old student at Western Washington University, has been involved in activism and direct action in the past. Last year, she climbed 60 feet up a Douglas fir tree in order to protest the construction of a mall on Bainbridge Island. D'Angelo was summoned by the Bellingham police on charges of misdemeanor and trespassing.
An oil spill that occurred off the coast of Santa Barbara last Tuesday is five times worse than originally predicted, according to officials in California. About 105,000 gallons of oil spilled, and it's now affecting a nine-mile stretch of beach. U.S. Coast Guard Captain Jennifer Williams said the spill could take months to clean up. The cause of the spill is still uncertain. The oil pipeline is owned by the company All Plains American. The company had been fined at least 10 times in four other states between 2004 and 2007. The U.S. Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Administration calls All Plains American the worst violators when it comes to oil spills.
Black veteran Malbert Cooper received a headstone in the Spokane Cheney Memorial Gardens after nearly 40 years in an unmarked grave. Cooper served as a sergeant in the Army from 1910 to 1916. He was buried in the 1970s by the Department of Public Assistance, who paid for the burial but would not pay for a headstone. The Department of Veteran Affairs provides headstones at no cost for soldiers who have been honorably discharged or killed in action. However, Cooper had no next of kin to apply for an application. Local Spokane resident Chuck Elmore helped Cooper get a headstone after 6 years wrangling with the VA. A dedication is planned for Wednesday at Fort George Wright in honor of Cooper's services.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Free Speech Radio News, followed by a story about Coca-Cola workers in Colombia on Labor Radio at 6. At 6:30, Adam Carpinelli interviews Dan Berger, the author of Captive Nation, Black Prison Organizing in the Civil Rights Era, on Prison Pipeline. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, News, Views, and Hip-Hop. Tomorrow's weather, cloudy in the morning, sunny in the afternoon, with a high of 73 and a low of 52. Today in history, in 1925, John T. Scopes was indicted for teaching the theory of evolution in a Tennessee high school. In 2013, Ukraine held its first gay pride parade in Kiev. The quote today, Memorial Day, is from George Washington: "Guard against the impostures of pretended patriotism."
Cleveland police officer was acquitted of voluntary manslaughter and felonious assault on Saturday. Officer Michael Brello was charged for shooting to death an unarmed couple in 2012 after a police chase. The couple was killed was black. Officer Brello is white and works in Cleveland, a majority black city. People in the community protested peacefully outside the Cleveland courthouse when the decision was made. Protesters also took to the street where the unarmed couple was killed, and were met by officers in riot gear. At least 71 of the protesters were arrested on the night of the decision. The shooting is yet another example of the strained and deteriorating relationship between police forces and communities, especially those communities of color. Marsha Fudge, a U.S. representative of Ohio, called the acquittal of Brello a, quote, "stunning setback," unquote, for justice. 10 different officers fired a total of 137 bullets at the couple during a 20-minute car chase. Brello killed the couple with 15 close-range shots from the hood of their car. Cleveland has been the site of a number of police shootings recently. The Department of Justice cited the Cleveland Police Department last November as engaging in a pattern of unreasonable or unnecessary use of force.
For more on the shooting in Cleveland, here's commentary by Mumia Abu-Jamal.
137 shots. A man drives his companion down a Cleveland street. And before he knows it, police sirens bite into the night air, sending a chill down his spine. He pushes his foot down on the accelerator, trying to avoid this madness. Little does he know that within minutes, he and his companion will be shown their last vision in life, 137 shots fired into them, courtesy Cleveland police. This happened in 2012. On Saturday, a judge there acquitted a cop involved in that shooting for leaping atop the car's hood and emptying his semi-automatic 15 shots into the bullet-ridden bodies of the two occupants of the car. 137 shots into a car of unarmed people, said to be sparked by a car's backfire. Legal, justifiable. The two had traces of drugs in their system, the judge noted. They were thus expendable. 137 shots. It's okay. No biggie. Boys will be boys, right? The law is naught but opinion, whether a judge's or anyone else for that matter. In the season of Ferguson, when youth are in the streets yelling Black Lives Matter, we learn that this is more aspiration than reality. It is a bitter hope in the cold kingdom of the law. For today, black lives don't matter a bit. From In Prison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Protesters were violently dragged off the street and arrested this weekend in Oakland. Citizens of Oakland were protesting the mayor's interpretation of an existing policy that she says bans nighttime protests. Police are now allowed to clear the streets and arrest protesters who participate in rallies after dark. On both Saturday and Sunday nights, protests ended with police brutalizing protesters. YouTube videos and pictures on Twitter capture the Oakland police using their force. The Sunday protest drew between 100 and 150 protesters. It was a day after peaceful protest in Cleveland over the acquittal of a white officer who killed an unarmed black couple.
It's 5:11. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Near my home in Austin, Texas, there's an old refurbished motel with a keep it real attitude that is expressed right on its iconic marquee. No additives, no preservatives, corporate-free since 1938. The good news is that more and more businesses across the country are adopting this attitude, providing a buy local, uncorporate, anti-chain alternative for customers. Food shoppers and restaurant goers, for example, have made a huge shift in recent years away from the likes of McDonald's, Pepsi, and Taco Bell, preferring upstart independent outfits with names like The Corner, Caleb's Cola, and U.S. Taco Company. But, guess who owns those little alternatives? Right, McDonald's, PepsiCo, and Taco Bell. Leave it to ethically challenged profiteering monopolists to grab such value-laden terms as genuine and honest, empty them of any authenticity, then hurl them back at consumers as shamefully deceptive marketing scams. In Huntington Beach, California, U.S. Taco Company poses as a hip surfer haunt, with a colorful Day of the Dead Mexican skull as its logo. The airy place peddles lobster tacos and other fancifuls at $3 or $4 each. Very unfast foody. Nowhere is it whispered that this is a big chain outlet created by a group of Taco Bell insiders. They even usurped the enterprising word entrepreneur, stripped it of its outsider connotation, and twisted it into a corporate vanity, calling themselves intrapreneurs. This is Jim Hightower saying, however, reality will out. Small and local has a genuine feel and flavor that the imitators can't sustain as they sprawl out into 10,000 stores. And as they do, it becomes obvious to customers that they've been duped. And that's not a good marketing strategy.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. and its allies have carried out 10 airstrikes in Syria and 25 airstrikes in Iraq since Sunday, according to news service Reuters. The purported targets of these strikes were ISIS strongholds. According to the U.S. Chief of Staff of the coalition effort, Kurdish fighters in northern Syria have helped capture an increasing amount of territory from militants.
Nobel Prize laureate and mathematician John Nash Jr. was killed in a car crash on the New Jersey Turnpike Saturday. John Nash was the inspiration for the movie A Beautiful Mind, starring Russell Crowe. Nash was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 1994 for his work on game theory, the mathematics of decision-making. Nash is also known for overcoming schizophrenia, and in recent years became an advocate for mental care in the state of New Jersey, where his son was diagnosed with schizophrenia. His wife was also killed in the crash. They were married. They had been married for 60 years.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As Canada's Radio Labor reports, McDonald's is using extraordinary measures to avoid paying taxes, not just in the U.S., but worldwide. As they pay near poverty-level wages here in the U.S., in Europe alone, McDonald's has avoided paying $1 billion in taxes in the past few years. Daniel Bertassa is Director of Policy and Governance at Public Services International.
And when corporations who are making large amounts of money avoid paying their taxes, then these public services, vital services like health, education, water, waste services, roads, these services are squeezed or cut, and sometimes they're privatized simply because some of the largest corporations, some of the most profitable corporations on the planet, aren't paying their fair share of tax.
This is Mitch Lawrence with the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News. You might have missed it, but basketball legend Isaiah Thomas is back in New York, where he is now running the Liberty. That's the women's basketball team in the WNBA. If that doesn't sound quite right, well, it isn't right. There's something very wrong with Thomas not just running the Liberty, but also buying a piece of it. Here's why it's wrong. Go back to the fall of 2007, and Isaiah Thomas was running the NBA's New York Knicks when he was at the center of an ugly sexual harassment trial involving a female executive at Madison Square Garden, which owns the Knicks and the Liberty. A jury in federal court in New York found that the Garden and Thomas's boss, James Dolan, guilty. And Thomas was cited for using crude language and also creating a hostile work environment. The female executive, Anuka Brown Sanders, wound up getting an award of close to $12 million. So now here we are, almost 8 years later, and how does Isaiah Thomas come back to oversee the women's pro basketball team? It's because he's still very close friends with Dolan, even after running the Knicks into the ground. Dolan has never accepted the federal jury's findings or the guilty verdict in the Brown Sanders case, so he is operating as if Thomas had never done anything wrong. So Thomas, who has been viewed as unemployable by the rest of the NBA, is back in business. And in this case, it's one sleazy business. For the Sports Minute for Workers Independent News, this is Mitch Lawrence.
WIN covers the low-wage worker movement like no other national radio newscast, putting a microphone in the hands of these workers to amplify their voices.
I'm so pumped up. I know that we're going to win, and we're not going to stop fighting until we win.
If you never fought for anything in your life, fight for this living wage so that the kids of our future have a way that we didn't have.
You can help us expand and improve our Raise the Wage Fight for 15 coverage. For more information, go to Indiegogo.com.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at IBEW.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Ireland made history Friday by becoming the first country to legalize gay marriage through a popular vote. 62% of the electorate voted yes for the measure in an election that had a 60% turnout. The Archbishop of Dublin said that the vote signaled a, quote, social revolution, unquote. About 80% of Irish people are Catholics, a religion that has been hostile to marriage equality historically. The country joins 19 other countries worldwide that have legalized gay marriage.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to This Week in Palestine, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, from May 16th to the 22nd, 2015. This week, the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas reiterated his commitment to the two-state solution. Meanwhile, Israeli attacks targeting Palestinian communities left one civilian killed. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Let's begin our weekly report, as usual, with the nonviolent activities organized in the West Bank. One youth was injured, and scores were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation when Israeli troops attacked nonviolent protests organized in West Bank villages on Friday. IMEMC's Majd Bajali with the details.
In the village of Kufr Kadum in northern West Bank, many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation as Israeli troops attacked the weekly protest there. Troops later stormed the village and fired tear gas into residents' homes. Meanwhile, in the villages of Bilayn and Na'lin in central West Bank, Israeli soldiers attacked protesters as soon as they reached the gate in the wall that separates local farmers from their lands. Many protesters suffered effects of tear gas inhalation and were treated by field medics at both locations. In Bilayn, soldiers arrested one resident during the protest. At the nearby Nabi Saleh village, one youth was injured after troops attacked protesters at the village entrance. Israeli soldiers fired several rounds of rubber-coated steel bullets and tear gas at protesters and nearby homes. Many residents suffered effects of tear gas inhalation as a result. Also on Friday, at the village of Al-Masara near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem, soldiers attacked villagers and their international supporters as soon as they reached the village entrance and forced them back. No injuries were reported. For IMEMC News, this is Majd Bajali.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas says that Palestinians are committed to a two-state solution. Meanwhile, Washington is concerned that current Israeli policies might affect U.S.'s external policies. IMEMC's Rami Al-Maghari with the story.
Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas opposed a provisional state on parts of the occupied Palestinian territories. He said that the Palestinian Authority is still committed to the two-state solution envisioned by Washington long ago. Abbas's remarks came during a public speech before the World Summit Economic Forum, known as Davos, and held this year in the Jordanian capital of Amman. The Western-backed president asserted on the PA's determination to look into ways to reconstruct the war-torn Gaza, despite the fact that the international community has not lived up with last year's pledge to fund that reconstruction. Meanwhile, World Bank issued a report suggesting that the Gaza Strip is on the brink of collapse unless the international community intervenes. In other news, the ruling Hamas party in Gaza rejected some media leaks that the party has been in indirect contacts with Israel over political solutions to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. A number of Hamas's spokespersons in Gaza were quoted as saying that there have been some sort of merely chatting with foreign delegations which have recently visited the coastal region. Ahmed Bahar, deputy speaker of the Hamas-dominated parliament in Gaza, told media outlets that his party is a resistance party that never believes in negotiations with the Israeli occupation. For IMEMC News, I am Rami Al-Mirari in Gaza.
This week, Israeli attacks left one man killed and one boy critically injured in Jerusalem. Moreover, the Israeli Navy continued to attack fishermen in Gaza. IMEMC's Iman Abadrabu Benoura reports.
A Palestinian child was critically injured on Thursday evening after Israeli forces shot him with a rubber-coated steel bullet near the Shafat refugee camp in occupied East Jerusalem. Yahya Sami Al-Amoudi, aged 10, was walking near a checkpoint by the occupied East Jerusalem refugee camp when he was shot by the bullet. The boy had a fractured skull, jaw and left ear, and had surgery to remove his left eye. Also in Jerusalem, Israeli police officer shot and killed on Wednesday morning a Palestinian driver after he allegedly rammed two police officers with his car. The deceased driver has been identified as Omran Abu Dhaim, 41 years of age, from Jabal al-Mukabbir in occupied East Jerusalem. A female and a male officer sustained light wounds due to the accident and were moved to hospitals in Jerusalem, Israeli sources reported. Palestinian eyewitnesses said the incident was an ordinary traffic accident, while the Israeli police is claiming its initial investigation indicates that the driver deliberately attacked the officers and tried to confirm the kill by reversing back over them. The incident led to clashes between Palestinian youth and Israeli police officers. Earlier in the week, a Palestinian woman from the southern West Bank city of Hebron suffered a miscarriage on Monday after a number of Israeli fanatics assaulted her in the center of the city, Palestinian medical sources reported. Mirvat Saad Abu Rumeyle, 37 years of age, was moved to the Hebron governmental hospital, suffering various cuts and bruises, and she also suffered the miscarriage as a result of being repeatedly beaten. The assailants came from the illegal Ramat Yishai outpost in the center of Hebron city. On Sunday, Israeli soldiers and police officers used excessive force against hundreds of Palestinians in occupied Jerusalem as they marched to counter a provocative Israeli procession marking the so-called Jerusalem Day, wounding at least 29 Palestinians and kidnapping 5. In the Gaza Strip this week, Israeli Navy ships attacked on Friday morning several Palestinian fishing boats in the Sudania area northwest of Gaza City, causing significant property damage. On Wednesday, Israeli military ships opened fire on Palestinian fishing boats in the Al-Waha and As-Sudani areas in Gaza, causing excessive property damage but no injuries. For IMEMC News, this is Iman Abdrabbo Bannoura.
And that's all for today from This Week in Palestine. This was the weekly report for May 16th to the 22nd, 2015, from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This week's report has been brought to you by Ghassan Bannoura and me, Camila Vincent.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. The producer for tonight's newscast is me, Eric Tegedoff. Our engineer is Michael Fuckless. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from the newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. Oregon Governor Kate Brown's number is 503-378-3111. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Eric Tegedoff.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Abe Proctor and Joe Uris host the Abe and Joe Talk radio show. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Robert Scheer speaks on free thought and censorship. At 10, Air Cascadia. Headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, Stage and Studio, a weekly show live featuring best of performing, literary, and media arts in Portland and beyond with D-May Roberts. And at 11:30 on Art Focus, guest host Kathleen Stevenson speaks with Aki Ishijima, a ceramic artist from Mashiko, Japan, and Ruri, a ceramic artist living in rural Yamhill County. They'll talk about the importance of Mashiko ceramics, the 2011 earthquake in Japan, and the devastation it caused for Mashiko potters. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent spring membership drive. If you missed it, you can still become a member by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Now stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News. Good evening, Eric.
Good evening, Liam.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
This is FSRN, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. Coming up on today's show, airstrikes and ground warfare resume in Yemen after a brief humanitarian lull. Congress moves one step closer to handing fast-track trade authority to the president. And Los Angeles becomes the largest city in the United States to approve a phased-in $15 an hour minimum wage. Those stories and more on FSRN's Weekly Edition. After a five-day humanitarian ceasefire expired, military intervention by U.S.-supported Saudi-led coalition forces continued this week in Yemen. According to the United Nations, at least 1,800 civilians have been killed since Riyadh began airstrikes under the moniker Operation Decisive Storm. Another 500,000 people have been displaced. The stated aim of the coalition, comprised mainly of Gulf monarchies, is to repel advances by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels who forced Yemeni President Abdrabu Mansur Hadi to flee the country in late March. Delivery of humanitarian aid has been difficult in the country that depends heavily on imports for medical purposes. A looming standoff with Iran regarding inspection of a ship laden with relief supplies was averted this week after the ship changed course for Djibouti, where inspectors are standing by. Distribution of what aid does arrive in the country is complicated by damage to infrastructure like airports and roadways. Shaheen Ahmad is a communications officer for the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC, based in Sana'a.
Actually, both shelling and fighting on the ground are affecting our access to those in need. Actually, the most problem that we're facing today is how we'll get through those front lines and access to those people injured and other civilians. And we have to talk to both parties just to get an agreement on that. Sometimes it's just about ceasefire. It's just a short one to get this access.
The Saudi-led coalition began airstrikes in Yemen soon after President Hadi left the country. Much of the arms used in the military action was acquired from the United States. According to Bill Hartung, senior advisor to the Security Assistance Monitor at the Center for International Policy, following a dramatic increase in U.S. arms sales to Gulf states during President Barack Obama's administration, Saudi Arabia is now far and away the biggest recipient of U.S. arms in the world.
The Obama administration has been pushing arms sales to the Gulf for two main reasons. One is political. The president doesn't want to fight another Bush-style, boots-on-the-ground Iraq war, so he's trying to support allies to carry out some of the things that U.S. troops might otherwise be required to do. Secondly, it's a big boost for the U.S. industry, which has seen a slight leveling off of Pentagon spending on weapons. Their agenda is to push heavily into exports, and the Obama administration is helping them with that.
Hartung says since President Obama took office, the U.S. has agreed to transfer nearly $80 billion in arms and defense services to Gulf Cooperation Council member states, at least three-quarters of which have gone to Saudi Arabia. A three-day meeting on Yemen held this week in Riyadh did not include Houthi negotiators. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has announced another meeting to be held next week between the rival Yemeni parties. The U.S. Senate has moved forward with Trade Promotion Authority, or TPA, this week, bringing it one step closer to becoming law. Also known as Fast Track Authority, the legislation sets up a framework for the president to sign trade deals with other countries that only requires an up or down vote from Congress. But hurdles remain as advocates and opponents alike now begin to shift their focus to the House of Representatives. Critics of TPA point to the recent World Trade Organization ruling against the U.S. food labeling program as an example of how the lack of input on fast-tracked trade deals affects consumers and citizens. But some members of Congress say the food labeling program has little to do with food safety and even less to do with TPA. Anthony J. Rivera has the story from Washington, D.C.
For people like Connecticut Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, the recent arbitration decision on meat labeling by the World Trade Organization, or WTO, is a canary in a coal mine. She, along with Congresswoman Shelley Pengree and Louise Slaughter, say the country of origin labeling program is just one example of weakened consumer safety standards in the name of trade. The program, known as COOL, requires imported beef, pork, and chicken to be marked with a specific label. But the WTO ruled against the program on the grounds that it diminished the value of other trade partners' products. In a press conference outside the House of Representatives, DeLauro says these labels inform and protect consumers.
We need to get this right. The health of our families is on the line right now. There are too many unanswered questions and too many corners around the TPP, which can lead to problems for public health.
TPA and the secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, have been very contentious issues on Capitol Hill during the past few weeks. Many Republicans have sided with President Obama, while many Democrats have opposed the sweeping trade authority. Senate progressives like Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Sherrod Brown led the charge against the trade deal, but their hand weakened in the days leading up to the cloture vote. But a few Republicans have also been hesitant to support TPA and TPP. Some see it as handing more power to the president. As time ran out before the Memorial Day recess, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell attempted to weaken the opposition's argument. This week, he held a press conference touting what he said would be the benefits of the trade deal for small businesses. McConnell also pointed out that the authority would be available to the next president, too. And that president, he says, could be a Republican. Texas Congressman Michael Conaway is the chairman of the House Agricultural Committee and says COOL is not only ineffective, but it's also redundant and wasteful. He dismisses DeLauro's argument and her insistence that food safety will be affected by the Trade Promotion Authority.
Those are false red herrings that the folks who are against trade, against TPA and against TPP or whatever, they're going to use no matter what. Her issue is safety, food safety. I got it. But she is gratuitously using this issue to try to support her argument on safety, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with safety.
Still, congressional supporters of the trade deal may be acting on blind faith. TPP negotiations are occurring behind closed doors, and official copies have not yet been made available to Congress. Most of what is known about the specifics of the agreement come from draft copies of chapters of the trade deal leaked by the whistleblower website WikiLeaks. Patrick Woodall, a research director at Food and Water Watch, an advocacy group seeking greater protection for consumers, warns there's more to worry about with TPA and TPP than lack of clarity in labeling. He details a litany of issues, such as antibiotics, in the WTO's Sanitary and Phytosanitary Measures, or SPS measures.
But here's the real problem, is that we know that the TPP is going to increase the imports. So even if it did nothing else, even if there was no SPS language in the TPP, our border inspectors would face a larger number of imports with the same capacity, which means we would inspect less.
With fast track authority progressing, a number of House members are paying close attention to the legislation's movement through the upper chamber. And interest groups are likely to adjust their strategies ahead of their last chance to stop it. Anthony J. Rivera, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
The Texas legislature, now in the final days of its 84th session, is in the process of debating and pushing through some controversial measures. One that's already been signed into law by the governor bars local municipalities from banning fracking operations in their communities. Other big issues on the agenda include LGBT equality and access to abortion services. For more on this session in the Texas legislature, FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Forrest Wilder, associate editor with the Texas Observer magazine.
Let's start with the bill signed into law Monday by Texas Governor Greg Abbott regarding local ballot initiatives on fracking. What does the new law do and how did it come about?
Well, basically what it does is it preempts cities, local governments from passing ordinances or establishing any rules or regulations regarding fracking. And specifically when I say fracking, I mean the subsurface activity. It says that that is the domain of the state. It allows some exemptions for cities to continue to regulate above surface activity or you know, things that aren't related to the actual fracking process, such as lights and noise and roads and that sort of thing. Although there is a question about whether some of those ordinances might be in jeopardy as well. Basically, this was in response to the city of Denton voters there overwhelmingly passing a ban on fracking within their city limits last November. And the bill, you know, you can see the sort of the power of the oil and gas industry in Texas. I mean, there was just nothing stopping this thing. I mean, it was just a steamroller. While they're still haggling over tax cuts and, you know, abortion and 500 other issues that may or may not see some action on it, this thing was just a done deal, you know, almost from the moment it was filed.
Do you know of any precedent where a state cherry picks what issues can and cannot be decided on by voters via ballot initiatives?
I can't think of anything in Texas. There have been other efforts here, for example, you know, Austin and Brownsville and a number of other Texas cities have banned essentially, you know, single-use plastic bags. And there's been efforts in a couple legislative sessions for the state to say, no, cities, you can't do that. But that's never gone anywhere. Same thing with regulations having to do with trees and that sort of thing. So this was I can't think of any precedent for this in Texas, but I don't know about other states.
There was also a slew of bills this session targeting the LGBT community. Can you give us an overview?
Yeah, this was a unprecedented session for mostly anti-LGBT legislation. We think it may have been the most bills, anti-LGBT bills ever filed in any legislature in modern American history. There was 20-something that were filed. A lot of them ended up just dying in committee. There was two that were advancing last week but appear for the time being to be dead. One would have essentially defunded county clerks who issue same-sex marriage licenses, you know, if and when a Supreme Court strikes down Texas's ban on same-sex marriage. That was the bill that had the kind of the most legs, the most political juice behind it, and it basically ran up against a deadline. So I think, you know, with the caveat that things could still happen, I think the kind of the story so far is that while there's this backlash that had been building and so many bills were filed that we're probably going to end this thing with just the status quo, and the marriage equality issue will just be, you know, left up to the Supreme Court for the time being.
There's been no shortage of controversial bills this session in the Texas legislature indicating a hard right turn. Can you briefly touch on some of the bills that haven't gotten much attention?
Yeah, and it's been a session in which we've seen a lot of ideas that never really were going to go anywhere suddenly become almost done deals. You know, open carry, for example, probably some of these abortion restrictions, and also in environmental legislation. This has been a really bad session for the environment. You know, HB 40, the anti-fracking ban, or the ban on fracking bans, of course, is, I put that at the top of any list. But there's other bills, too, that are they've gotten less attention that would restrict, for example, the citizens' ability to challenge polluter permits. That one has gone off to the governor. I would be shocked if he didn't sign it or allow it to go into law. You know, there are other bills that have been working their way through the process. One that would basically eliminate the Texas's renewable energy mandates. So it's, you know, it's been kind of a gloomy session, I think, for folks that are, you know, kind of center left on a lot of issues. Primarily because of the consequences of the elections last year.
Forrest Wilder is an associate editor with the Texas Observer. He joined us by phone from Austin, Texas. For FSRN, I'm Shannon Young.
The plight of farmers in India is drawing global attention after a recent spate of suicides. More than a quarter of a million farmers have killed themselves in the past two decades. Their deaths often linked to crop damage, low yield, and debt. Debt which does not pass down to heirs in India after death. The most recent rash of suicides began with a 41-year-old farmer who hanged himself at a political rally. The demonstration was held in opposition to a land reform measure that would allow the government to take over private lands for corporate and industrial development and has been very controversial in recent years. FSRN's Jasvinder Sehgal attended the farmer's funeral.
The sound of weeping fills the village of Nangal Jhamarwada. Local residents, farmers, and many political leaders have come to attend the cremation of the late Gajinder Singh. Singh committed suicide by hanging himself on a branch of a tree just a few feet from a stage where politicians were busy speaking against a controversial land reform bill. Gajinder's younger brother, Brijinder Singh, says his brother could have been saved if the political leaders had tried to bring him down from the tree rather than finish their speeches.
My brother would still be alive if anyone at the rally had seriously tried to save him. I don't want to blame anyone, neither the police nor the organizers. I simply know this. A farmer climbed a tree to commit suicide. He was a human being who should have been saved on humanitarian grounds.
Hundreds of farmers have come to participate in the funeral, and every one of them wishes to console the bereaved family. Among them is Lakhan Singh, who traveled more than 50 miles to be here.
He was a great man who laid his life down for the rights of farmers, as he was one of the few educated farmers, and he raised his voice for our rights. Like us, he was dependent on agriculture for his livelihood.
Before committing suicide, Gajinder tossed a suicide note into the crowd in which he says he lost his entire crop in last month's severe storms. Singh says that the government is underestimating the extent of crop damages to avoid paying disaster assistance.
Our entire crops have been damaged by rain and hailstorms, but local officials say that the damage is only 23%, and that estimate deprives us of government compensation paid only when a natural calamity damages more.